We want a smash, crash, bash, smash, blast the system. We want to get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We want to make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision. We want liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. On today's program, we discuss journalism and Latin America. We will be joined by Callie Persol and T.M. Scruggs. Please stay with us.
We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollars.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Later on, we'll be joined by Amy Casey. Desiree McSwain is out for today's show, but she'll be joining us again soon. We are broadcasting once again from lovely Hayward, California at the California State University East Bay campus and excited to talk about Latin America and journalism. Amy, why don't you tell us who's going to be on the show today?
This is Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. Today's guest is Callie Persol, who is just returning from Cuba. In addition to Callie, we'll also be joined by T.M. Scruggs, a musicologist and Media Freedom Foundation board member returning from Nicaragua. But before we get to Callie and T.M., I would like to remind our listeners to go to our Patreon page. That's www.patreon.com/projectcensored. There you can access past shows and exclusive content. You can also find a new segment that we're about to start called Nick's Flicks. And on the Patreon page, you can find the list of 5 documentaries or films relating to authoritarianism and politics. The movies that are on the list include Gabriel Over the White House, The Great Dictator, The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, and The Candidate. The first show in Nick's Flicks will look at the 1972 film called The Candidate. And again, you can find that and the rest of the list on patreon.com/projectcensored. At this time, I would like to remind you to please send us your feedback at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter. Nolan is @Nolan_Higdon, and Nick is @DrDreadlocks. That is DrDreadlocks.
All right. Thank you very much, Amy. And yeah, looking forward to checking out The Candidate, the first in the series of Nick's Flicks. It's a great program for educators, concerned citizens, and film buffs. So we had another interesting week for media, and Nick in particular. I really want to get your take on this. There seems to be this trend, it drives me insane, that these real newsworthy events do happen, but it's not a distraction. It's almost like a swerve takes place in the coverage. And for example, when we're looking at the horrific events that happened in Charlottesville, we saw the reaction of people on the streets, the justification for these white supremacists. But the conversation shifts to whether or not we should take down historical monuments, which I agree is an important conversation. But I think it swerves us away from where the conversation actually began. And I've seen this happen elsewhere, too. Like when we were talking about the Russia investigation every single day of the week, then all of a sudden he says he's going to put an LGBTQI ban in the military. There, another example, too, was we're talking about how Harvey, the response to Hurricane Harvey, was weak and poor and inept. And then all of a sudden we're talking about DACA. And it's this swerve technique he's able to do to really kind of distract from these other issues. And I don't want to confuse our listeners and say that DACA or LGBTQ ban or historical monuments is not an important issue. What I'm saying is he swerves to choose which issue that we end up focusing upon. And the media seems to go with it. They still have not had this so-called come to Jesus moment. Would you agree?
I would agree. Trump, to a degree. I like the term swerve. The other term for it might be chaos. Another way of thinking about it is as a pinball machine. Your media are essentially the pinball itself bouncing around from one subject to the next. And frankly, what's interesting is that because we bounce across these, DACA, the investigation, the Mueller investigation, North Korea, threats of North Korea, now we're dealing with severe storms in Florida. We keep bouncing back and forth. It's hard to keep your eye on the ball about what's really going on and what's happening in terms of executive orders to continue to downsize and eliminate regulations. We're not even having a discussion, for example, about whether or not we've properly funded FEMA. Do we have an acting FEMA director who's capable of handling these severe storms that we're dealing with? But if you wouldn't mind me going back to the discussion about historical monuments, because I think that that was the most clever swerve, as you call it. The discussion about historical monuments was really one that right-wing media, I think, felt very capable of dealing with. It was easier for them to talk about monuments and preserving history than it was for them to sort of explicitly defend white nationalists, white supremacists, and Nazis. But the real conversation about these monuments isn't just a conversation about tearing them down. It's about the fact that these monuments are not properly contextualized. So, for example, you'll have a Robert E. Lee Square, but you won't have a Denmark Vesey or Gabriel Prosser Square. You won't have a marker in your town of where the slave auction took place. So these people appear heroic, decontextualized in the South as heroic figures, and they cannot be and are not surrounded by the other markers of the things that happened in their time.
I would agree. And for our listeners, too, Denmark Vesey and Gabriel led to slave revolts.
Yes.
That Dr. Bayham is talking about there. Yeah, this discussion about public space is really where the discussion lies, right? This is public space, so it is up for public debate. But for some reason, that there's this justification almost that, like, because it's been there a long time, then it's okay. Mm-hmm. And that's the logic behind a lot of these decisions. So it's tough to kind of unearth that. But I think, again, it's sort of, as you pointed out, it was a swerve away from the topic. They felt like they could win that because they could say, point to Jefferson and Washington and pull people's heartstrings about the patriotism. And they would think this is an attack on patriotism, and they would have the moral ground because people love eagles picking up trouts out of rivers and stuff like that. But it swerved from the larger discussion that they were having at that time. And so I know why the president does this. He's a man-child. His candidate as a goal is to distract from these actual conversations. What I can't figure out is why the media takes the bait on this every time. That's the perplexing question.
Well, I mean, the answer for everything in a capitalist society is money. So if they're getting viewership, and let's face it, it as awful as it sounds, people watch. Let's just talk about storm coverage. People watch storm coverage. People watch disasters. People will watch it. If Antifa and Nazis are fighting in the streets, they'll watch that stuff. So most of the stuff that they've looked at, even the tearing down of the monuments, people will watch that because there's a kind of a violence to it, right? It becomes a kind of a theater. And it's a theater without substance because, again, we're not talking about anything of any meaning. When we watch fights between Nazis and Antifa, we have empty discussions about who both of these groups really are and how long they've been around in our country. They're totally decontextualized. When you watch film of these monuments coming down, there's no real understanding of when those monuments were put up. So you say, for example, as the media says, mainstream media, they've been up for a long time. Well, they haven't. Many of those monuments have been up since the civil rights movement. And they're a part of discouraging that civil rights movement and reinforcing white supremacy. Many of those monuments are not even in the South. So, for example, Oregon has a bunch of these monuments. Why? Oregon wasn't even around, you know, during the Civil War. But if we properly contextualize those, there were a lot of Southerners who went there and to some of the other territories where these monuments now exist. So these monuments, if we properly historicize them, are a political project. But the media goes to this in a decontextualized fashion because it's sexy, because there's violence, there's conflict, people are pulling things down, people are screaming at one another, spraying mace in one another's faces. And that's what sells.
So I want to get to you is one other thing in addition to that you brought up too, because if we didn't bring this up, we'd be remiss. You're talking about the violence and the sensationalism of these conflicts and these groups like Antifa and others on the left. And we've done a pretty good job here, I think, of criticizing a lot of right-wing media and right-wing groups. Do you think that this left-wing violence is that some of these people are conflating news coverage with making a difference. And so this violence is a way to get news coverage. And as a secondary question, something I've thought about often is authoritarian states, and you can go back to Nazi Germany is one of the main points of this. The left finally reacted with violence because they realized the system was stacked against them. But that actually empowered the system to justify going after leftists. So they were an outsider group attacking. Is that – do you think that with all we've been talking about authoritarianism in the show, do you think this is planting those seeds?
Yes, you mean in the sense of the media manipulating the violence of Antifa in order to create a counterculture or counter-narrative of right-wing or police suppression of their voices?
Yes, and like, will it justify the Trump administration spying on, attacking, infiltrating leftist groups, and the public will largely go along with it because they'll remember the violence that's perpetrated by this one or small group?
Yes, I mean, this is for me why, as a protester, I'm a nonviolent protester. I can't. For me, nonviolence is a way of life, subscribe to Dr. King's ideas and methodologies. I don't want to make any particular judgment here and now about Antifa, but I think it's safe to say that some of the things that have been said about Antifa are undoubtedly true, and there are things that have not been said about Antifa. For example, the fact that they responded to some of these hurricanes by providing help, assistance. I think also the organization of Antifa has not really been explored. I was listening to, I believe his name is Mark Bray, who's written an interesting book, The Antifa Handbook. And one of the questions that he asks, that Antifa raises, which I think is a great question to ask, is at what point in time is it legitimate to be violent, morally legitimate to be violent? Now, again, as someone who believes in the ethics of nonviolence and nonviolent practice, it's a very difficult discussion for me. But I think we can say historically, was it okay to kill Nazis in World War II? I think most people would probably agree. Even if you hate the idea of killing, which we all do, I think most people would agree that that's fine. Is it okay to kill slave masters? Now, for me as a professor of African American studies, obviously I have to contextualize that within the gruesome history of slavery, right? And people who did, Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, there are hundreds of these slave revolts, right? These are revolutionaries to me. It was legitimate for them, in my view, to engage in violent acts. So what's the line for Antifa? When do you begin, if you're inclined to violence or self-defense, when do you begin to engage in violence and self-defense? At what point in time does the Nazi uprising or the alt-right, as they like to call it, reach a level that you have to be in the street and you have to be engaging physically?
We want to continue this conversation. We will in our authoritarianism series, which you can catch online. Also, reach out to us on Twitter at Nolan_Higdon, or you can contact Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks, or you can email us at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. We return. We're going to shift the conversation to Latin America. We'll be back after the short music break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Nicholas Baham III. And we're going to shift our conversation now to talk about Latin America. In particular, we're going to talk about Cuba. Our guest is Callie Purcell. She is a journalist with a Bachelor of Arts degree in communication. Her degree focused on media production. Callie is a managing editor for the Pioneer newspaper at California State University, East Bay, and has produced hundreds of news stories. Her work mostly focuses on women's rights and feminist issues. She is returning from a two-week trip she just had in Havana, Cuba, where she reported on women's activism. Callie, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much, you guys, for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
So what can you tell us about your trip, like logistically, how long it was, kind of where you stayed, those sorts of things?
Yeah, so it was about 2.5 weeks in Havana. Stayed at a hotel in Vedado, which is a different part of Havana. And there was about 25 of us who went on the trip. We all tackled a different subject for our project, and it was really cool. We got to work together, even though we had different topics. We kind of got to learn a little bit about each one, I'd say.
Oh, cool. So there was, and I'm sorry, how many of you were there?
25, and then Dr. Carderis and Casey Beck.
Cool. So tell us, what was it like being an American? Because so many, especially American listeners, Cuba's kind of been the off limits for the last 50 years, even though people from around the world have traveled to Cuba and the U.S., it's been off limits. So what was it like being there? What can you tell American listeners about the experience?
For me, it was life-changing because I have never been out of the United States before. I definitely expected, well, I'm not sure what I expected, actually. It was just completely, completely life-changing, I'd say. One thing for me was difficult coming to terms with not being able to speak the language. I figured people would speak more English there, which was kind of maybe a stupid assumption. But anyway, yeah, it was definitely...
Well, we've invaded them enough time. You figured that would be the case, so it's not stupid. Don't worry.
It was really eye-opening to know in America here, you're just mostly taught about American history growing up, say. So being there, it's, yeah, there is this other part of the world outside of America we don't really hear about all the time. We're always concerned with just what's going on here most of the time. So it was really eye-opening, like I said, just to know there's so much rich culture out there that we don't get to see every day.
So you work on a lot of feminist issues, and I'm wondering if you had any opportunity to engage Cuban feminists, if it's proper to use that term. Actually, and if there's anything that you noticed in terms of reported openings in Cuba on LGBTQ rights.
Yeah, so I did talk to a number of different people, not anyone directly involved in those issues. That would be CENESEX, I think, is the major organization that advocates for LGBT rights and women's rights. Also, another organization, there's only like two major ones. And I talked to a women's studies professor from the university. She told me a bit about the movement, the women's movement in Cuba. I'm not sure if feminist is a correct term in Cuba, but I know that I chose to focus on women because during the revolution, Fidel Castro really made it a priority to increase women's rights. But on paper, women have rights a lot of the time, I noticed in my research and talking to people. But when it comes down to it every day, for example, the organizations that really advocate for women, their interests are in the revolution first, even before women. So it's pretty interesting to see that, the separation, really.
Mm-hmm. So what can you tell us about, what about like the nightlife or what it's like being there on an average day for what you saw in Cuba?
Something I really enjoyed about Cuba was the feeling that everybody, it was really communal there. When you go out at night, everyone's out, there's music playing till late. Everyone's in the streets. Everyone's really friendly, hanging out with each other. It just seemed more connected, the culture in general. You'd walk past someone on the street and they'd make eye contact and not break it. It was just, it was different than here.
Did you have a chance to talk to a lot of locals when you were there? Get an idea of how they feel about you as an American and how they kind of feel about maybe post-Fidel Castro Cuba or any of those type of things?
Yeah, a little bit. Like I said, I didn't speak the language, so it kind of made it harder for me to talk to locals like that. But I think, well, the impression I got was that people are generally pretty curious to talk to Americans, pretty happy we were there. Half the people would say that it's a good thing after Castro, and other people expressed loyalty to the current government. So I think a lot of it may have been out of fear to speak out, or just genuine support for it.
The history of Cuba, and I'm going back to the history of colonialism and slavery in Cuba, mm-hmm. makes Cuba a part of the broader African diaspora. And I know that there have been issues with respect to race in the country. And so you mentioned something about sort of on paper and in practice with respect to the lives of women and also people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. And I'm wondering if you saw some similar things with respect to race, skin color difference, things like that.
I did read a little bit about that before going. Since it wasn't my focus for the project, I didn't dive into that stuff as much. but I did have a friend who was covering Afro-Cuban culture, mm-hmm. and she noticed there was, there is some issues with that. I don't feel comfortable speaking on it exactly. I'm not sure what she really dug up. But yeah, skin color does play a part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. And then with respect to what you said earlier about women in the revolution, this is actually something that interests me because it sort of surfaces in African-American political history, too, where women have always been asked to sublimate their issues in favor of the race. So it sounds like that's a similar deal going on here, that women are asked to sublimate their issues in favor of the revolution.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I would say that for sure. And also, you brought up skin color being an issue there. And now that I think of it, talking to the women's studies professor, she was talking about women getting the right to vote and that being race being secondary to that, like in America. How that
okay. Out. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a long history of that, as you point out as well, that the women is 51% of the population have to give in on their rights as a way for what is supposedly seen as the larger picture. That's also worth mentioning. Our director and engineer, Mitch Scorza, he accompanied you on this trip as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
What did Mitch do?
Mitch covered baseball, and he worked on the documentary. It was really turned out really good.
So you let him have all the fun, basically, is what you're saying.
They definitely had fun. I know that.
Mitch is a wonderful director and engineer, but I never talked to him about cool stuff like that. So I should have brought that up to him.
Should have brought him in here.
But and so as a young journalist, I have to ask, because we really want to support young journalists, big proponent of young journalists, what would you kind of see as like the same or different between being a young journalist in Cuba as compared to what you do here in the United States?
Oh, there's so much more freedom in the United States, for sure. There's state journalists there. I think they mainly report on what they government wants them to. I don't think there's as much freedom here, especially right now. I think journalism in the United States is so important because of the political administration and current issues going on. It's important to dig things up, get to the bottom of it, but I don't think Cuban journalists have the same freedoms or even ability to do that. It's really censored still.
And so you think that was really noticeable, you thought?
Definitely.
What about, is there many college newspaper programs that you came across that are in Cuba or no?
Not that I came across. There was a few notable publications, but mainly run by the state. So not at all like this.
So can I ask you a question, too, about positionality? So coming as a young white woman journalist and trying to engage in dialogue with Cuban women and other journalists, what was sort of the relationship there? I mean, you know, were people open to talking to you? Did you need to sort of deconstruct whiteness while being there? Find some other way to sort of work with your definitions of feminism, their definitions of feminism, things like that?
Yeah, I definitely think there was a point where we had to kind of agree on what those feminist issues are. And it's very different in different countries, especially there. It's way more controlled still. Women have a lot less rights and practice, I think, there. And I think that's just part of the culture in general. But just talking to the women's studies professor in particular was really eye-opening, hearing about how the revolution comes first. And women, they fall second in this machismo society.
I see.
Yeah.
Kelly, you produced some of these articles. What are some of the articles you produced, and where can people find them?
Yeah, sure. So we actually had to write 6 blog posts while we were there about different things we experienced throughout the days. And the whole goal of going was to produce a final project. So some people did documentaries. Others, like myself, did a long-form article with photos. So they're on the COM website, actually. I'm not sure the exact address of that, but
so people can go to California State University East Bay's main webpage and access the communications department. Or they can go to the Pioneer website, too. What's the address for the Pioneer's website?
I think it's just the Pioneer online. Yeah, you could go on through the COM page, I think is the best way. And then it's organized under each person that went and what they covered and what those topics were.
Okay. Thank you very much. She is Callie Bersall. And Callie, if people want to get a hold of you, how can they do that?
You can reach me on Twitter is the easiest way. I think it's LittleMissOptimist, little_miss_optimist.
That's what we're missing from this show. We need optimism.
Exactly.
See?
Optimism.
See? We need optimism.
That's what the young journalists are bringing is optimism.
Someone needs to.
That's right.
All right. Well, Kelly, thank you very much for being on the Project Censored show. We're happy to have you. And we're going to be back with TM Scruggs after this short musical break.
This is Amy Casey, special announcer for Project Censored, and this is By the Numbers, Latin America edition. In 2017, Venezuela's government reports nearly 10,000 homicides, 92% involving firearms, from January to mid-August, with estimations predicting roughly 33,000 violent deaths by year's end. Also in 2017, Haiti sources 78% of its energy from renewables, Guatemala 59%, and Nicaragua 51%, compared to the U.S. at 8%. For more information like this, please go to patreon.com/projectcensored. This has been By the Numbers. I am Amy Casey, and you're listening to the Project Censored show.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Bam III, and we are talking about Latin America today.
T.M. Scruggs is an anthropomusicologist and musician. He has published on Central American music and dance in audio, video, and print format, being the principal contributor and consultant for major reference works on the subject. His recordings, done inside musicians' living rooms and in street processions, were released as Nicaraguan folk music from Messiah on Flying Fish Records and was nominated for 2 Indies for Best Liner Notes and World Music Release on an independent label. Unknown sources within Nicaragua continue to honor the album by continually bootlegging it.
All right. Welcome to the show, TM.
Thanks.
And so... TM, you just returned from a trip to Nicaragua, correct?
Yeah, a couple months ago.
Yeah, so tell our listeners a lot. I don't think a lot of American listeners get a chance to go down to Nicaragua. So tell us, like, what's the experience like, maybe compared to the U.S.?
I especially comparing it to how I first encountered it, which was in the 1980s. And I had done solidarity work on Central America. And then when I went back to school, it was time to choose a doctoral dissertation project. And I decided, well, let's see what's written on Nicaraguan music. And I looked in the brand new 36-volume dictionary, really encyclopedia, and there were 3 paragraphs on Nicaragua, which I now know was about 50% accurate. 3 paragraphs on Honduras and the same one on Salvador. We were lucky to have someone do something on the marimba in Guatemala. And Costa Rica was fairly well represented. Panama wasn't so great. So I decided to see if it was safe enough to go do the work. And at that time, the Contra War was the terrorists. Contras were up in the north in the hills. And so where I was thinking of doing my work, which is on the marimba, that's very particular to Nicaragua. It's just a 22-key diatonic, like the white keys of a piano marimba. It was very safe. And so I lived there. I first went in 84. I came back in 85. I did some recordings while I was there, 86, some more recordings. And then Ronald Reagan paid me to research the music of the people he was trying to kill when I got a Fulbright grant and lived there for 2 years, from 87 to 89. I went back in 90 during the elections, and that was a big drop-off of people coming to visit Nicaragua after the Sandinistas lost the national elections. The first elections were in 84, first free elections in Nicaragua basically ever. And then the second in 1990 because of the war and the embargo of that prohibited American materials being imported, and everything was made in the United States. So if there was a screw that you needed for your machinery, you couldn't get that screw. And if you improvised, then it would start to mess up the machine, and before you know it, the whole machine was worthless. And so people just said, we're done, and a new government more right-wing and more pro-United States government. In fact, basically, the United States designed the campaign strategy. And it's changed a lot since then because that's when people who had left with money started to come back. And that's just been a gradual process. And the last few years, there has really been quite an uptick in economic activity and a new wrinkle. North Americans, United States citizens, going down to retire in Nicaragua. And the airplane, when I first went back down last year in November, I got myself into business class, and every person except two were Americans, and they were all talking about housing deals. Someone was buying a house, someone was selling a house. So I'm on a couple of new email newsletters about people talking about being an expatriate retiring to Nicaragua.
That's fascinating, given the history.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about sort of the relationship between music and revolutionary praxis, in particular in the Sandinista era. Mm-hmm. For a lot of us, like when I was in college, through a lot of that, I became aware of what was going on, really, after I picked up the Clash's album Sandinista, and then began reading a lot more broadly about what was going on. And I know that they were deeply influenced by some of the music coming out of that region as well.
Mm-hmm. They didn't hear that much music, actually. They, because I met Joe Strummer later. He was in the movie Walker.
Yes.
Yeah, and so when I came down there in 87, they were filming. And so I went down there and I had a chance to hang out with them and talk and stuff and see them on the set, making this movie. And they knew about what was being done to the Nicaraguan people by the United States government. And so they just decided, let's do something about Nicaragua on our next album. And they went down to the Solidarity Committee office and just basically swept them clean, got mm-hmm. everything they could and talked to them. And then it was from that and other stuff that they came up with their own tunes. But the music itself, they didn't really know much about. But in fact, the music was incredibly important for the revolution, for the overthrow of the Somoza dictatorship.
Yes.
That the final victory came in July 19th, 1979, when the Citizens' Army, the Sandinista troops, finally made it to the center of Managua. And there's one particular person named Carlos Mejia Godoy, and he was a singer-songwriter who was radicalized the more he went out into the more popular classes, and he was fascinated by culture, everyday culture. And he's like a walking encyclopedia of refrains and jokes and all the names for things. Like when I first met him, we were talking for a while, he starts telling me I have to go by Tomas down there. Having letters for a name just got to be too awkward. So I used my legal first name, Tomas. And he was saying, marimba has the following folk meetings, like a marimba of children, like a whole bunch of children, or the road when a dirt and gravel road from rain and use, how it kind of looks like how do you describe this on radio? Kind of like an accordion that's been opened up, that up and down kind of thing. And they say, it's all marimbaed out because it looks like marimba keys and that sort. And his first album came out in the mid-70s. And he was quite daring in including subtle messages of valorization of the popular classes and especially rural folklore, and even some fairly direct criticism of the current government that was there. So, for example, the revolution, in a way, really entered a new phase when there was this horrific earthquake in December of 1972. And for those of us, even now, if you go to Nicaragua, there's still empty lots in the middle of downtown Managua. And when I hear people from Costa Rica tell me that they used to fly, the upper classes used to fly to Managua to go shopping, I just can't even imagine, because in my mind, Costa Rica is much more developed than Nicaragua. But that's how it used to be. And it was what really turned people against Somoza in a way that they were willing to go up against this murderous National Guard that the United States originally created back in the 1930s. Because when the international aid came in, there was such total open theft of the aid that even the business class started to turn against Somoza. And that's when you started having this kind of broad front against the dictatorship. And he had a famous song, Pancho de los Escombros, Pancho of the Ruins, where his main character says, yes, I work in the ruins. I'm paid by the government to help clear these things away. And he has a line there. We had a lot of hope when we heard that, tinned cans of meat were coming. He says, but, and there's a pause in the way the music goes, but, the big fish always swallows the sardine. And everyone understood what that meant.
Yes.
It meant that Somoza's henchmen got all the aid and very little trickled down to the people who needed it the most. And he had a radio show, talk about the power of radio, where he was at one point officially joined the Sandinista Front, but secretly. He was underground, wasn't known. And he would give coded messages because the way so much community radio and even some commercial radio in Latin America works is that there's a constant phone line opening for people calling in to give a request. Can you dedicate the following song to so-and-so? We used to have that more here in the United States back in the day, before my day.
Yes, before corporate radio.
Yeah, exactly. And but even when we have a nonprofit community radio, we're not really into song dedications in the way that they are in a lot of Latin America. And so he was able to then just invent some dedications besides real ones and say, Jose's, there's this message out in the week out, but to, whoever, one, the package will arrive tomorrow. things like
great.
This.
Great, yes.
And I went around interviewing people in the late 1980s to try and hear about what they thought about Carlos Mejia Godoy and music in general. And I was taken aback that more than one person, as we talked more, we had a chance to have a more in-depth interview, just kind of relax and just chat more. And they kind of, their minds went back 10 years, to start thinking about how things were and start remembering. And without me prompting at all, I had several people say, the impact of the music of Carlos Mejia really weighed about as much as everything else the front did combined.
That's fascinating.
I mean, and they're including military action.
Yes.
Just because it gave people a new sense of worth of their own culture, because up until that time, music that was composed was using Mexican forms. And the impact of Mexican music was tremendous, the Canción Ranchera, where, the mariachi sings and the singers in the front. And the best-known popular music singer-songwriter before Carlos Mejia used to write in using Mexican Canción Rancheras, but the lyrics would be about Nicaragua.
So it occurs to me as you're telling this that one of the ways you can tell the power of culture is looking at how an invading force tries to control culture, right? Like the U.S. in Nicaragua trying to control schools and labor relations and market relations. Do you have any – I have never studied this. Did you come across any U.S. trying to create music culture or entertainment culture as a way to manipulate the population in Nicaragua?
Well, no, not in deliberately trying to come up with something. They weren't doing that. They were just, putting mines in the roads and blowing up schools and killing teachers. They started with a literacy campaign in 1980, the next year. The first victims of the terrorist Contras were volunteers from the city who went out to teach people how to read and write. Same in Cuba. The first victims of, after the revolution, they actually had power. They actually had the government. Were the people on the literacy campaign who went out. That was an interesting thing when people, internationalists, volunteers would come into Nicaragua to see it so they could come back and say what they saw, and people came to volunteer in various ways for different lengths of time and so on. And people who, sometimes people would say, It's so terrible how North American culture is around here, you know, in a general sense, you know, not just Nicaragua. And I would just point out that people take what they like, you know. And I was up in the far north remote areas, and there are these kids doing breakdancing, you know, and their favorite thing was Michael Jackson. You know, that's what they were into. But the only manipulation of the United States of culture and was music during that time. And what they did was they got a contra guy to take some of the same songs by Carlos Mejia and others and then put new words to them. And then they had a huge radio presence up in the mountains because they had a lot of money. And they were able to broadcast and blanket the area in a way that the Nicaraguan government couldn't do. And this was like out of Honduras.
Oh, so okay, so that's very interesting. So they would take these same songs, change the lyrics to have probably more pro-U.S. or more Somoza family influence, right?
Well, Somoza was so discredited that they had a different strategy. It's kind of like, you know, against the communist Sandinistas.
Yeah.
And then just kind of some vague thing that was supposed to be better. Kind of like, you know, repeal.
Yeah.
Repeal Obamacare, but we're not going to tell you what it's going to be.
Right.
So it's kind of, yeah, let's repeal the communist Sandinistas that are, you know, they're causing all these problems, but we're not going to tell you what it's going to be afterwards, seeing as how the person who was in charge of them was probably a lieutenant in the old National Guard of Somoza. I met the one, they actually put out an LP at one point, and I met the guy because I had a job. My first job was at Florida International University in Miami, and I asked around, and I managed to find this guy, and I interviewed the guy who put out this album of music by the Contras. And he did it for the money, pure and simple. He did it for the money. That's where he was at.
Hey, can I ask you, because you've mentioned the influence of Mexican music, and you've also mentioned the influence of American popular music. And I'm just sort of curious how Nicaraguan musical forms reflect the struggles of indigeneity, in particular with not just with reference to the United States or Mexico, but with respect to Nicaragua's own colonial history and Spanish identity in Nicaragua.
How long is this show?
Right.
Go for extra innings.
I could just get out my dissertation and start.
Right, there you go.
Because that's what it's all about. It's an example. Matter of fact, I guess I could still use the expression as Mexican sub-imperialism, or you know, cultural imperialism, because the effect of Mexican culture was so strong because of the movie industry. And the golden age of that movie industry was in the late 30s and through the 40s. And it was so incredible that people in Buenos Aires knew these ranchera tunes because they were so catchy and they were so well done. Remember, a lot of American movies, too, used to be that they would have a lot of music in them, you know, like Gene Autry, the Singing Cowboy, was not unusual. You know, you'd have the dance break in the part of the story, you know, and Fred Astaire would dance around or whatever, and then they'd come back. There was a lot more integration of that within movies as opposed to a soundtrack, having all the music, and then the actors never actually do anything musical. And so that was a big impact. And there was a feeling within Nicaragua by some peoples, and these are people more, you know, upper working class, middle class, that we need to have a song form that is identifiably Nicaraguan and stop imitating this central Mexican. Remember, inside Mexico, you know, South Mexico was being ignored too. So you never heard the kind of music from Chiapas and so on. It was all based on the northern stuff for the mariachi. And there was one man, Carlos Zapata, who then took a strumming pattern that you find in the Nicaraguan marimba music tradition. And in that tradition, unlike most places, the marimba you have to play sitting down. There's a hoop off it. It's, you know, it's an African recreation by where exactly which Africans, when in Central America is an open question, but we know that it came from Africa in the head, you know, of people who were brought over. And then there's a guitar on one side and a smaller guitar on the other side. So it's always a trio. And so the strumming pattern of the guitar player is what he started using and playing with. And it's a basic 6-8, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's kind of opposite emphasis of the waltz. So a waltz, which would be a little slower, would be right? But there's the other way around, and it's just off. It's not, and it's can be hard for people to pick up that slight difference, and it's a different way you just kind of strum up with your fingers. And having heard so much marimba music, when I finally got a hold of the guitar, I went to this guy who I had interviewed because he's one of the top musicians, and he said, well, I'll give you some lessons in guitar. And he sat down, and I was able to play the Sonico, you know, more or less right away, and he just was like, no one can do this. And I said, well, I've been listening to marimba music for 2 years, so, you know. And they created a music, then they came up with different names, but they finally decided to call it the Sonica. Nica is short for Nicaraguan, and son is a generic word in Spanish that just means, you know, musical type. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in Cuba,
the son
from Eastern Cuba has been so popular that now they just call that the Cuban son, although it's really son montuno.
Which is accompanied by some very European-esque dancing in the sense of, you know.
Couple dancing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, but not the way they move.
Exactly. you have to look at both parts of the body to see. So that upper part looks very European.
Yeah.
And then that lower part is doing its own thing.
It's doing an effort.
Right.
That's right. And that's why it's always hard for North Americans to kind of get the idea of don't move with the shoulders. Move those hips.
Yes.
And so in Nicaragua, they also have that same impact of the Spanish influence for couple dancing and not moving the upper torso so much. But there the mixture is not with Africans, because there were hardly any Africans in Nicaragua, especially in the western part where 90% of the population lives. Afro-Nicaraguans are on the Caribbean coast. They call it the Atlantic coast. And those people are from Trinidad and Jamaica and other past histories and have very different culture.
Yes.
And they use their hips. But the son Nica, the idea was like there's a son jalisciense from Jalisco. That's what mariachi music is. You know, then there's, you know, sones from different parts of Mexico. So they thought, okay, we're going to have our own son. And there was really a push for people in the early 70s when that came out to stay within. There's like a certain kind of controversy within the singer-songwriters. You should only stay in the son Nica because that's ours. And when Carlos Mejia, his major songs were mostly in that son Nica form. But then he started writing things in some other forms, and it was kind of a national debate and so on.
That's fascinating.
So, Tim, where can people find some of the work you've done on these topics? Because it's so fascinating. Radio shows are so small, so short, I mean. So where can people find some of the work you've done? It's fascinating.
Well, you can always just Google my name. That's a pretty there's not a whole lot of people with my name. So it's T.M. Scruggs, S-C-R-U-G-G-S. And frankly, that'll be the best. Also, if you get into an academic portal of some kind, then, you know, like if you have access to a library and then you Google my name, then a bunch of articles and chapters. I was going to write the book, but lightning literally hit our house and we lost everything. Just when I had the grant to write the book. I used to teach at the University of Iowa. I was the token ethnomusicologist for 20 years. I'm trying to copyleft that expression. Token ethnomusicologist. So I don't. That's actually what I'm returning to now.
Oh, good.
My kids are finally out of high school. I have time, and I can travel and go back.
You use the term anthropomusicologist, which I find interesting.
Yeah, I did that deliberately just to show. We had the unfortunate historical fact that the guy that decided to come up with the name to distinguish us from musicologists who only do the European classical tradition.
Right.
So they got there first, right? So they just call themselves musicologists.
Right.
So there was a need back in the mid-50s when this was finally getting into institutions a little bit to come up with something that would distinguish us. And it was a Dutch guy, and he, Jaap Kunst, and he unfortunately thought of ethnos instead of anthropos. So like, you know, ethnology and anthropology. So he chose ethno. And first it was ethno-musicology, and then it just became one word. But it's unfortunate because, especially in English, ethno also is related to ethnic, and people think, oh, it's ethnic music. Well, of course, you know, European classical music is an ethnic music.
It is indeed.
And so really what helps distinguish us is that we are not looking at historical times that have passed, but are current, and therefore, like anthropology, you can do the field work and actually talk to the people who right. are doing it and embed yourself in the culture.
We were talking about, you said you're working now, returning to where lightning had struck and your home life, but you do a ton of other work. You're also on the Media Freedom Foundation board. You're at the Real News Network, right? Mm-hmm. So what are you doing with those projects as well?
Well, before I went back to school, I had a kind of a long hiatus, which if there's any students listening, you know, if you're not sure you want to go to graduate school, don't. You know, go work for a while. And then when you go back to school, you will just love it, you know. So. Unless you had an amazing job. And I just was noticing, trying to do solidarity work for Chileans and for Nicaraguans and so on, how media was really the battleground. You know, how can we get the word out? And I'm sure other people have said it, but I heard it from Bob McChesney, the great professor of media studies. And he said, whatever your primary passion is, your secondary one needs to be media. Because that's how things will get out, and that's how what you do will get framed by the people who then hear it later. So I've worked in a lot of community radio, and I was really excited by the Real News, and so I've been trying to build them up. And we have studios in Baltimore, so come on by, visit us. I think we're the, by default, the largest, you know, professional and television video studios that are not either governmental or commercial.
TM Scruggs, you're always a fascinating interview. Only takes like two questions. I love it. Hey, we're going to have
thank you,
we're gonna have
you
back on and have some yes. of your music in here as well. We want to hear
that'd
it.
That'd be great.
All right, TM, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And all right, listeners, we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in the studio with my co-host, Nicholas Baham III. We here at the Media Freedom Foundation produce content that illuminates the work of fact-based journalists around the world and offers alternative narratives to the corporate press. Amy Casey is here to tell us more.
From the Media Freedom Foundation, I am Amy Casey with some highlights of student-generated content. From the Global Critical Media Literacies webpage, gcml.org, Dr. Rob Williams and his student, Sandro Pobrick from the University of Vermont, have published an article titled The Facebook Future. As a business administration major, Sandro focused on the revolutionary website that paved the way for its own competition and the necessary adaptations required to remain relevant in the rapidly changing social media scene on the internet via the World Wide Web and smartphones application. Also at published an article titled Hashtag Hollywood, In a Relationship with Social Media. Callie Mae Bowen utilizes her academic major in studies to report the symbiotic and evolutionary relationship between Hollywood and social media, specifically the users and consumers of social media who ultimately drive the industry. Dr. Rob Williams and his student, Wild Sudbe from the University of Vermont, have published an article titled Living in a New World of Technological Clairvoyance. The article notes the collection, analysis, and redistribution of personal data provided willingly by users of social media accounts and GPS services to predict future behaviors. This story can be found at gcml.org. From Sonoma State University, the birthplace of Project Censored, Professor Emily Joy Clark and her student Jessica Mena Flores have nominated a validated independent news story, that is, a story overlooked by the corporate press but reported by the independent press, titled Hacker Rigged Elections in 9 Latin American Countries. The story reports of a now-incarcerated Colombian hacker who claims to have helped conservative political candidates win elections. That can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, this time from Diablo Valley College, Project Censored director Mickey Huff and his student, Anthony Ray, have published Pen America Reports on Impact of Interrogation of Artists and Travelers. The story describes the effect of President Trump's immigration policies on artistic and intellectual travelers who have been interrogated and detained despite lack of criminal history. That can also be found at projectcensored.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/podcast. There you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. Also, don't forget to send us your feedback. Questions, comments, concerns, anything you'd like us to know can be sent to our email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Your feedback can also be directed to Twitter. You can find Nolan at Nolan_Higdon or Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks. That's DocTorDredlocks. Thank you for listening. I'm Amy Casey, and that is the news that did not make the news.
Thank you very much, Amy. And I want to remind our listeners, make sure you check out the first episode of Nick's Flicks, where you can find that at patreon.com/Project Censored. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon with my co-host Nicholas Bayham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and hosts. Our intern and special announcer is Amy Casey. Mitch Scorza is our director and engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com and visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all our radio shows for the past 6 years, as well as 40 years of the news that didn't make the news. Special thanks to our guests, Callie Persaud and T.M. Scruggs. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of the thought brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. The people organized can build.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured.